Hello, and welcome to That's Theatre, Darling, a podcast that shouts from the rooftops about the skill, creativity, and passion of all of the people who make theatre happen. My name is Amy, and I am thrilled to have you here. Let's get the show on the road, shall we? Today, I am overjoyed to be introducing you to an extraordinarily talented composer who I've had the pleasure of working with a couple of times now. I am very excited to get into chatting with him because I cannot wait to get an insight into how his clever musical brain works. It is the ever so brilliant Orlando Goff. Hello.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm surviving.
Good, good. Okay. Glad to hear it.
Yeah, you know, I work in mostly in theatre and choral music, so things are not absolutely perfect at the moment.
Yeah.
But there is some showing signs of life.
Yes, yes, which is the main thing. It's so lovely to have you here. Thank you so much for joining me.
Pleasure.
As I mentioned in the intro, we have worked together a couple of times now. Once on a production of Othello, in which you composed the most stunning music. That song at the end of the play used to give me goosebumps every single night. It was just so beautiful.
Oh, that, yes. Actually, Polly Harvey should take most of the credit for that. But it actually was a good arrangement.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was so gorgeous. And then we also worked on a play called Iam together, where you made up a whole new language for some crows, which is just incredible.
So we did. Yeah, well, I mean, crows have got to have some language, and we made it up. Yeah.
Can you sort of explain a bit about the crow singing language and how that came about?
Well, I've always been very fascinated, actually, by birdsong. Mm. And whether bird, you know, in what ways birds are communicating, and whether they're singing just for the sake of it, or whether they're flirting, giving each other warnings. I was very intrigued to invent this crow language. And the play was set in the plague, 1665, and the crows were the kind of harbingers of the plague. It was like the crows knew what was going on and were kind of gathering round, ready, presumably, to feast on the carcasses of people who died.
Yeah.
So I invented a language which consisted of turning a lot of words backwards. It was like a sort of, I suppose it was like the idea of a kind of black mass, so that it was kind of mainly prayers then sung backwards. Mm. And it has the most curious kind of feel. It sounds Scandinavian, but in a really beautiful way, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it was incredible. It was so incredible. I mean, I remember the day that you came in and you said, right, we're going to start singing songs in this language. And the actors were like, what? This is incredible.
Yes. And actually actors are great, I think, because they'll take that kind of thing on. Mm. They're often very anxious about other aspects of the performance, like, you know, what's my motivation and all that kind of thing, understandably.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
what acting's about. But when it comes to music is somehow, I think for a lot of actors, it's a kind of relief. You're doing something that's slightly outside your normal job, as it were, and it's quite fun. Mm. And somebody comes in and says, okay, we're going to sing like crows today. And you think, yeah, okay, yeah, I'd like to do that.
Yeah, and I guess it kind of, in a way, it's quite freeing in the sense of it's quite structured, because obviously you've got the melody and you've got the words, and it's kind of, you don't have to think about your motivation necessarily. I mean, obviously, when you are, because you're sort of acting as you're obviously acting as you're singing. But I mean, the crows, they just had hoods and masks and things as well, didn't they? So actually, they did.
So they didn't have to do a lot of explicit acting. No, it was quite freeing. I think it's true actually that when you're singing in theatre, it is definitely different from speaking. Mm. Because you're given more, you are given more information in a way. You have, in a sense, you're making fewer decisions.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. So I would love to dive in with my first question, which is, I'd love to know what you can remember about the very first show that you ever saw in a theatre.
Well, I started very, very early because I come from quite a theatrical family. Mm. And my father who is actually a physics teacher at a public school, also directed the school plays.
Oh, wow.
So I think I was seeing plays sort of before I could speak.
Yeah.
The first professional theatre I remember going to, we lived in Brighton, and my parents would take me to Chichester Festival Theatre. And we would go by train because my parents didn't drive, and we would go the night before because my father, particularly, not so much my mother, but my father was very thrifty. So he wanted to get cheap tickets so that we'd go the night before and we'd queue overnight. The Chichester Festival Theatre had a huge cantilevered awning so that you could sleep. So we'd take our sleeping bags and sleep overnight. So we were ready at 9 o'clock or whatever it was to buy these tickets. And I wouldn't sleep very much. I was very excited and kind of, we were sort of in the middle of a park. So that kind of wasn't, you know, very easy to sleep, and you'd wake up when it got light. So we do that, buy the tickets. So by that time I was kind of really tired. And then we would be in Chichester all day and then we'd watch the play. So I think it's quite typical, actually, being a child, that you kind of remember the things that surround the piece more than the actual piece. And in fact, I mean, actually, we were seeing some amazing things. I mean, we saw something which now seems absolutely bizarre, which was Laurence Olivier playing Othello. So Laurence Olivier, a white man, blacked up, playing Othello.
Oh, my God.
And of course, I can't claim to have realised how weird that was. And the culture at the time allowed that kind of thing, in the sense that, you know, the TV had a show called The Black and White Minstrel Show, in which all the performers were white, but some of them were blacked up. I mean, looking back, it's kind of beyond weird. But there it was. And Olivier, you know, this great actor, played Othello, and that was absolutely fine. Fine at the time. So that, you know, so that was interesting. And then I saw, for instance, an amazing play, which I do remember very well, called The Royal Hunt of the Sun, which is by Peter Shaffer, which is a huge play about the Spanish coming to America. And the kind of cultural clash between the Spaniards and the local people, which was huge play and really amazing and just sort of fantastic looking. And Chichester Festival Theatre is a rather wonderful theatre. It's kind of open stage and felt very exciting just to be there. I remember that feeling of being just really thinking, oh, you know, sitting down thinking, whoa, you know, this is good. Not a proscenium arch, you know, you felt very much part of the action.
That's great. So you've had such a kind of, you know, such a brilliantly varied and full career. And so I was wondering if it's possible for you to distill that down into a bit of a highlights reel with regards to how you got into theatre particularly, and then how it's brought you to where you are now.
Yes. Well, yeah, because my father used to direct these plays, I was always really interested. And in fact, occasionally he'd let me write the music for the plays that he was directing. So at the age of about 15, I remember writing the music for The Trojan Women, which is I didn't know what I was doing. But, you know, he was very helpful.
Yeah.
Then I went to uni. So still wasn't into professional theatre there. Came to London, was squatting in Warren Street with Boy George living on one side.
The
other was the Open Space Theatre, which was one of the first, it may even have been the first fringe theatre in London. And that was really exciting to go there and see what was happening there.
Yeah.
Then I started a band called The Lost Jockey, which played systems music, sort of the last Steve Reich, and then our own music. And then that morphed into a kind of more sensible version of itself called Man Jumping. And at that time, I met, and this is in a way the most important moment of my life, I met a really wonderful choreographer called Ian Spink, who was running a company called Second Stride, which was kind of dance theatre. And that was my introduction to theatre. And so for quite a long time, I was making music for dance theatre. And then for dance, that was a big part of what I did. And then I only gradually got into what you might call normal theatre, whatever, you know, plays, yeah, writing music for plays. By which time I'd also started writing operas. And then I started a choir called The Shout and really got stuck into vocal music, and became obsessed with vocal music, which very much directed how I felt about theatre, that I wanted mainly to be writing for the voice. I wasn't particularly interested in writing instrumental background music. I really, really wanted to write songs. So that was a big thing. So this choir, The Shout, lasted for about 10 years until it was kind of killed off by the recession in 2008. And since then, I've been working on all sorts of different projects, sort of music for art installations, music for dance, operas, theatre. And then I do a lot of outdoor site-specific work, theatrical work, and a lot of working with amateur singers, which I love doing. And that's, so there's a kind of, there's quite an interesting kind of continuum of singers that I like working with, from professional singers to actors who are very good at singing, who I love working with, to amateur singers. And then I've recently been involved in a long project called Stroke Odysseys, where I've been working with people who've had strokes, who are stroke survivors, who have all sorts of problems, aphasic problems with speaking, but can often sing really well. So I'm fascinated with singing in all its possible versions.
Yeah, wow, that's incredible. I mean, such
that's it. That's my career. We can
such a breadth. Yeah, done. Tick.
Done.
Such a breadth of exciting things. I mean, it's so funny with my career. It's so kind of funneled into a certain area, whereas actually you've got such a breadth of things to get excited about and to get interested in, and it just sounds wonderful.
Well, as a composer, you can choose to do one thing, and of course, if you're very good at that thing, that might be a very good idea. You know, like writing film music, which I'm not very good at. So, but actually, as a composer, in order to make a living, it's quite a good idea to do lots of things. But also, of course, it's really interesting to kind of go into lots of different areas. I mean, one of the nicest jobs I've done recently, and one I was able to do with COVID raging, was to do the music for a lighting installation in California by a lovely artist called Bruce Munro. And he's made a huge lighting installation, and I've done music for it.
Wow.
And I mean, it's just a really nice job.
Yeah.
You know, can you say?
Yeah.
No, I really enjoyed it. So yeah, it's good. It's rather lovely to both be involved in all sorts of things. And you know, I've been involved in writing music for TV at times and film, but mainly I'd be really interested in theatre, but theatre in its kind of wide, very, very widest sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I would love to know how on earth you go about composing a show. Are there kind of steps or a process that you usually go through, or is it more organic than that? Kind of lots of questions in one, but I didn't really know how to articulate it in one question.
No, it's a good question. And it very much depends on who I'm working with, and also kind of what medium. I mean, dance is very interesting, because when I started writing for dance, there was generally a way of working where you talk to the choreographer, and then, as a composer, you'd write a piece that might be 10 minutes long, might be an hour and a half. And then the choreographer would listen to it in fantastic detail and then start making steps inspired by the music. Well, most choreographers don't work like that anymore. And they tend to work by starting with an idea and making movement.
Right.
Challenging, usually challenging their dancers to make movement, and then gradually forming it into a piece. And as a composer, your relationship to that is very, very different. You're also writing as you go along and trying to find the right ways to express things that you're seeing in the rehearsal.
Yeah. Studio. Wow.
And that's much more like working on a play, where you are, as a composer, a cog in a machine. And you're finding out what the director's thinking, finding out what the actors are capable of.
Yes.
And then I'm thinking of singing mainly here.
Yeah.
And then writing something that fits in very much with how the director is thinking. For instance, on Eam with the crows, the crow idea came from Adele Thomas, the director.
Yeah.
And she had already thought about how the crows would look and what their part, what their role was in the piece. And so part of my job was done in a way. It was because she'd had a really strong idea about what the crows should be. And I was just trying to fit in with what she was thinking.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, I kind of came up with this mad language and the music, but it was all very much based on what she's thinking. And I would be sending her demos of various ideas for what the crows might sound like. And she'd be going, not sure about that. Ooh, yes, that sounds like a crow kind of thing. Curiously enough, the crows, that was very beautiful, the music of the crows. You'd expect the crow music to be really ugly, but it wasn't.
No, it wasn't at all.
It wasn't at all. But that was her, in a way, that was her choice, because I gave her the choice of some ugly crow music, and she went, oh, no, the crows would be really beautiful. So we're all the way through, it's kind of making little sorties, making little demos, just suggesting things, getting feedback, and then continuing to work. It's very, very collaborative, and I really enjoy that. And yet I also enjoy the experience of, for instance, writing an opera, which is so different. I mean, you could say you're basically doing the same thing, which is trying to express a story in music. But in an opera, you've done pretty much all your work before the rehearsal started.
Yeah.
You've worked alone, really, and you've got feedback. You're talking to the librettist, obviously, and you're talking probably to the director as well, but it's very different. You're very, as a composer, you're very much in charge, and you're making an enormous amount of decisions about what the piece should be like, which is very unlike a play where you're working very much the other way around.
And a lot of it is informed in a play. A lot of it is informed by what happens in rehearsals and kind of morphs into different things as you explore.
Exactly. And it's interesting that, for instance, when doing a play, the actors are simply not expected to turn up for the first rehearsal knowing all their lines. That's not the point. They're exploring the play from the beginning.
Yeah.
In an opera, the singers are expected to turn up for the rehearsal knowing their entire part.
Yeah, wow.
So that you're already, the piece is already much closer to being formed. You generally have less rehearsal time. Opera's insanely expensive.
Yeah.
But it's, I think that's very interesting. And that as an opera director, it was slightly what we were talking about before, a lot of the decisions have already been made. So you have slightly less room to wiggle in.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've got a big and deliberately vague question for you now. Where do your ideas come from?
That's a very big question. Like a lot of composers, I actually don't listen to an enormous amount of music.
Yeah.
It seems really weird. I mean, I do listen to music. And I have passions.
Yeah.
Musical passions, and which are always informing what I write. I know that. I mean, it's not conscious normally, but they're there. And you know, I have a fantastic passion for Björk, and I have a great passion for Stravinsky, and I have a great passion for Monteverdi, and those are just, they hover. And I had actually, part of my upbringing was which I'm really grateful for, which is my parents were very into classical music, including contemporary classical music. And they would be dragging me off to concerts at Queen Elizabeth Hall to listen to avant-garde composers. And at the same time, my elder brother Piers was coming back home with pop music records. And so I've always really had a very kind of eclectic taste in music, and I'm very, very keen on certain kinds of folk music. A lot of Eastern European folk music I absolutely love, and I know that those things just come, particularly Bulgarian music, and those things just come into my music all the time, so I'm inspired by that. But then I'm very inspired often by visual things, and it happens to me quite often when I probably at the first rehearsal of a play, and the designer shows the design, the model for the design, and that really just really gets me going. It's very difficult to say how, because of course translating visual things into music is very mysterious, but there's something about seeing that mise-en-scène which is really, really inspiring, I find. And then I get inspired by ideas. I mean, Adele coming up and saying, right, some of the actors are going to be crows, I'm immediately interested, you know, because that's a strange idea and needs thinking. How does a person play a bird? You know, what does that mean? You know, how can a human sing like a bird? What is that? You know, we know that humans can't sing like birds. Birds sing something like three octaves of four octaves above a human, and they have the ability to sing much more quickly than we can. So what does that mean? So that's really inspiring. I find that kind of challenge really inspiring. I'm also on the lookout, because I'm so interested in vocal music, I'm on the lookout for the way that people speak.
Okay.
And for the inflections of their voices, because the way that people speak changes all the time, and not just in the words that they're using, but the way that people use words. You know, the most obvious example, which is a bit Mickey Mouse, is the kind of what is it called, the interrogative thing that a lot of people do at the end of their sentences.
Yeah.
You know, that didn't exist 20, 30, 40 years ago. And now it's a big thing about the way people speak. And I really enjoy listening to the way that people speak and then thinking about how that might turn into singing.
Wow, that's so interesting. I've never thought about that before, but it's all sounds, isn't it? It's all, you know.
It's all sound.
Yeah. That's such an interesting.
And if you think, that I'm fascinated by that, that there's kind of a sort of sense of a very kind of high art singing, like a Monteverdi madrigal, which is very pure and incredibly beautiful and very, very sung. And then there's the way that people speak. But then there's everything in between that.
Yeah.
And all those sounds that people make that can be incorporated into the way you sing. And if you listen to Björk sing, for instance, she's always incorporating little mannerisms and strange little sighs and very human sounds into the way that she sings. So it's not kind of pure in the Monteverdi sense, in the classical sense, but it's incredibly expressive. And those kind of expressive noises that people make, then when you incorporate them into singing, then you've got this fantastic kind of support. I really like that.
Yeah. Wow. That's fascinating. I love that. In your opinion, what is the importance of music in theatre? What part do you think it plays?
Well, of course, it's perfectly possible to write an absolutely fantastically brilliant play that doesn't have any music in it, doesn't need any music, and that's totally fine. But there's another kind of theatre, and that the theatre that I really love, as I would as a composer, which has to have music in a way. And one of my great fascinations is Greek theatre, because we think of it as the kind of emergence of theatre in the West anyway. And it seems to me that they just got it right straight off. I mean, what an astonishing invention.
Yeah.
That you had this combination of spoken word and something which was might have been singing or some kind of rhythmic chanting or done by the chorus. That you had the beginnings already of a sung theatre. You had something that was going to lead much, much, much later to opera. I mean, it's astonishing how long it took for opera to invent it. I mean, there must have been some kinds of music theatre before then, but opera didn't really emerge till about 1600, you know, whereas Greek theatre was thousands of years before that. And I'm just amazed. And yeah, a few years ago, I had the opportunity of writing music for the Bacchae, Euripides, the Bacchae. It was just such a fantastically wonderful job, because you get this integration of singing and speaking. And I find that incredibly exciting. I mean, I remember the first time I went to see Cheap by Jowl Company and just being completely bowled over by the fact that they were all really good actors, and you'd hear this spoken dialogue, and then suddenly they'd all start playing instruments and singing, and I just thought, this is just how the world should be.
Yeah.
And so I think, I suppose it's a question of seeing theatre as a kind of holistic thing, which is about every aspect of human, endeavor, human possibility, that you can sing, you can dance, you can move around, you can jump up and down, you can hang from the ceiling, and all those things can be in a piece of theatre. It doesn't have to be just people sitting and talking to each other.
Mm.
And so I've always loved that. And then you look at Shakespeare, for instance, he was onto that. So many of the plays have got these incredibly beautiful songs, and he was a really brilliant writer of song lyrics. He knew how to write a song which was only probably four lines or something, but just could totally encapsulate in what it needed to be said. And so emerging from him, I mean, that actually was a key moment really in theatre, I guess, 1600, because opera was emerging and Shakespeare was happening, which was also pretty important, and both very concerned with music. You know, opera obviously massively concerned with music, and plays acknowledging that. And then, of course, there's a whole era where I think music was much less important in plays. I feel when we get to George Bernard Shaw, and you know, the sort of through the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century, music didn't seem that important to them. And I think I sort of feel, I may be wrong about this, but in the 60s, 70s and up to the present day, we've got much more interested. We got interested in physical theatre. We realised that movement was incredibly important in theatre. And I think we've realised that singing is very important in theatre. And you can see now that when people are trained at theatre schools, all those things are on the agenda.
Yeah.
And it's not a coincidence, because we are really interested. And I can't remember when I last saw a play which only had speaking in it. It's really unusual.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It really is.
And a play like Eam, which is set in this village in Derbyshire where they got the plague. Singing seems incredibly important to something like that, because it was very much part of the community, as it must have been in 1665, that people sang. People sang religious songs and people sang secular songs, and that was part of the way they were. And of course, weirdly now, we don't do so much of that. We don't do sing-alongs. We do karaoke, but we don't so much do community singing.
Which I wish we did.
which I wish we did. Although, you know, choirs are doing pretty well at the moment, actually. Well, actually not at this very moment. They're not doing anything at all. It's a nightmare. It's a bloody nightmare being in a choir. You have to do Zoom rehearsals, which is completely
tough.
Completely weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, really rough.
Yeah. What would you say has been your proudest or most memorable moment in your career so far? Big question.
Well, the things that give me the absolute biggest buzz are successful outdoor site-specific pieces. I did a piece in Stuttgart on the River Neckar with about 20 boats and 20 choirs singing. And there was a kind of boat choreography and a human choreography going on, this big outdoor event in a harbour with a lot of fabulous looking and industrial buildings as a backdrop, big silos and warehouses. And in front of it, this kind of boat choreography on the river. and choirs and soloists singing to an audience on one side of the river.
Wow.
It's really nice. It's a piece which in a way was nice for me because I work in theatre so much, so I'm always thinking about what things mean and how to interpret that in music. And in this case, the piece didn't really exactly mean anything. It was just a piece which was about displaying these choirs and displaying this city in a very unusual way. It needed a director, and it was theatrical.
Yeah.
But it wasn't directly about meaning a narrative. And that was very enjoyable.
Yeah.
So that was a good moment. There've been other ones actually. I did a really great piece at the Almedia not long ago called Mr. Burns, which was directed by the amazing Rob Icke, who was a bit of a genius, which is a play by a New York writer called Anne Washburn. Act one, post-apocalyptic, whole bunch of people sitting around a fire trying to remember an episode of The Simpsons and not really managing it very well. Act two, they've decided to kind of monetize this idea in this post-apocalyptic chaotic situation by performing bits of Simpsons and also getting people to kind of remember stuff on their behalf. Act three is an opera based on this episode of The Simpsons came through. And it's just most bizarre play, really wonderful. What was needed was some geniuses to be in it, actors who could really, really, really sing. Mm. So we nicked a lot of people who'd been in London Road, the Adam Cork piece at the National, absolutely brilliant piece. People who could really, really, really sing, and did this extraordinary, really extraordinary piece. And what happened was that that the Almeida faithful came along, the kind of Islington Arterati, middle-aged Arterati came along and absolutely loathed it. Just hated it. Half of them hadn't seen The Simpsons, so just thought it was all a load of nonsense. And then fortunately, it kind of found its audience, which was more like 25-year-olds and who could kind of get the point. And it was such an amazing, weird piece. I wrote the music with a marvellous man, Michael Henry, and we directed the whole the music of it and together. And it was just a really, really exhilarating thing.
Yeah.
To be getting into Anne Washburn's extraordinary mind and partly into Rob Icke's equally extraordinary mind. And I guess that's sort of when I get really excited about theatre, is when I find myself doing something I would never, ever, ever, ever have thought of myself.
Yeah.
And just lucky enough to be kind of in the right place at the right time, being able to contribute to something which is really, really exciting.
So those
kind of things. I think that's it. It's finding yourself in a really, really weird place. Doing something that you never imagined doing. What could be better?
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree.
You probably have exactly the same feeling. You know, there were moments actually when we were working on Ian when I thought, wow, you know, this is an amazing place to be doing this. You know, there we were in the Globe, which is always rather wonderful working in the Globe because it's pretty strange. And doing this very strange play, with a bunch of crows and thinking, this is where I'd like to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm with you there 100%. So we're moving on now to the quickfire question section, in which I'll ask you a series of questions that you haven't seen before this recording, putting you in the hot seat.
Oh my God, it's like reality TV.
I know, right? So my first question is, if you could give your younger self some advice when you were just starting out in your career, what advice would you give yourself?
Don't be put off by failure, I think, because things that go slightly wrong are really, really instructive. And And I guess the thing is, I realized looking back on my career, I've just done a series of things which have been kind of imperfect. And all you can do is to do those things and then think, okay, right, I learned from that. I hope I can use that information for my next piece and just gradually learn. I mean, to be honest, now, much, much later, there are still things go horribly wrong. And there are things that I still don't get right and things that I still don't understand. But that's, in a way, that's it. I guess that's the journey again, isn't it? That's what's interesting. That's what makes it interesting. It's still a challenge. You know, if now at my age I could just think, oh, well, I've got that sorted. You know how to do this. You know, writing music for plays, you know, that's no problem. But it's not. There's always things that come up. And of course, that's what makes it really, really interesting.
I read on your website, actually, a friend of yours had said something about mistakes or things that you've done wrong and stuff. It's the compost for your future.
Isn't that, it's beautiful, actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, my friend Sue Davis, who's a brilliant choreographer, has a website on which she's put up pretty much everything that she's ever done, you know, videos of all sorts of stuff that she's done. And obviously it's an archive, but she said this brilliant thing about it, that it should be compost for future projects. And I just love that idea. That it's, apart from the fact that it's so modest and humble, it's also such a creative idea that somehow you watch all this stuff that she's done. And what she's saying is you don't even have to kind of like it or think it's marvelous. You just look at it and think, how does that feed into something? And that's, I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. So you're always, you've got these building blocks, using a different metaphor, for the projects that you're doing. And I think it's a really useful way of thinking.
I love that. And I love the idea that you've got all the compost from your own life, but also from other people's lives. As you say, looking at her website and looking at her archive is the compost for then feeds into an idea that you've then got for a piece of music. I just thought that was such a wonderful way of describing sort of work and life. And
it is an absolutely brilliant. I love it. I love it. And I suppose it's the same, you know, it's part of the same idea when you're doing a big collaborative theatre piece that you're learning at the time, you're learning from everybody that you're working with and being inspired by everybody you're working with and occasionally infuriated, of course, but, you know, inspired too. But also all the other experiences from all the other pieces and everybody's are all going into it. I mean, that is quite a lot of compost.
Incredible.
And you could argue that it gets a bit too much, but I've never found that. I think that we're quite good at sort of processing those experiences, actually.
I'd love that.
And it's certainly true that, you know, it's particularly true, actually, of writing an opera, writing a good opera is unbelievably difficult to do, which is why it's so tempting to try. It's such a challenge. And all those, you need all those experiences. You need all that compost in order to do it because it's tough. You
know? Yeah. I mean, I can't even imagine how tough it is. Who would be your dream person to work with that you've not had the chance to work with before?
Well, God, the list is absolutely massive. I mean, let's say, for example, Björk. Oh, my God, that would be amazing. let's say, I know I'm only give one answer, Robert Lepage. That would be absolutely insanely brilliant. And yet, let's say the person at the moment I'm just about to invite to work with me is Helen MacDonald, who wrote an unbelievably beautiful book called H's of a Hawk, which was about her experience of training a hawk while recovering from her father dying. So it's not, actually, what I'm saying is not just theatre people, but all sorts of people. I'd really like to collaborate with. Many, many singers. Oh, God, the list of singers just goes on and on and on. If only.
Yeah.
I can but try.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. If you could do a job swap for a day with somebody else who works in theatre, whose job would you like to try out and why?
Oh, my God. God, that would be such fun. That is so nice. I'd be a hopeless stage manager because I'd forget everything. I'd love to try out being a lighting designer. That would be amazing. Although I do recognise I don't really have the skills. I think it probably takes a bit of time to acquire them. But I'm fascinated by lighting in theatre, and a good lighting designer can just transform how you see a piece.
Yeah.
And take you into a world that you never thought you'd be in. I have such admiration for the way they work. They work incredibly quickly and often under quite stressful circumstances because everybody else is trying to do all their stuff and kind of put the piece together at the same time. And the lighting designer is having to stay incredibly calm, I think, and work sort of over the top of all this kind of chaos.
Yes.
I just have such admiration for them. And I'm often just bowled over by what I see. And it happens in dance very much too. There's a slightly different way of lighting dance. You seem to use much more kind of cross light, and which just brings the whole thing completely to life. And you've seen something in the rehearsal studio and you think, yeah, looks okay, it's all right. And then you see it on stage lit and it's just fabulously exciting. And I think one of the great skills of a director is to be able to have that imagination to realize that it can be transformed in that way.
Yeah, just adding that other layer. I think that happens with a lot of departments, doesn't it, in theatre? It's once you add another layer, it's just then becomes so much more exciting, and then you add another layer and it's so much more exciting.
Yes. That's absolutely true. And there's this strange, I mean, the way that theatre works is very odd, that you do all this work in the rehearsal studio and then you kind of arrive on stage for the technical rehearsal, and it's a bit of a shock because stage feels very, very different from the rehearsal studio, obviously. And then you've got all these extra elements that are coming in, so it's very labor intensive is not quite the right word, frenetic is probably the right word. Yes. Everything's happening at once and in quite a short time. And whereas on the continent, people tend to have very long technical rehearsals, here we have much more condensed ones where you're always working against time. And as a composer, weirdly, I quite like not to be there. you can't get a grip on the things that you'd like to get a grip on. You can only really get a grip when you get into previews and then into performances and really start to mold it, because everybody's thinking about the stuff in the tech, understandably. And I find that really frustrating. And then I'm often asked to judge sound levels, which are also incredibly difficult to judge because maybe people are not giving their absolute acting mostest. And so it's very hard to tell precisely what's going on. So yeah, I find technical rehearsals can be a bit of a pain in the neck. But on the other hand, I appreciate that in some ways they are the most exciting part of the process because as you say, all these layers are being added and the piece is being amazingly transformed.
Before your very eyes.
As a composer, particularly if you've as I would always aim to do, is to written a lot of songs for the piece, they probably have been incorporated already. Whereas if you're doing that kind of thing that I don't like doing it for plays, which is writing scene change music, then the tech can be the moment where you're churning it out and the director's kind of going, oh my God, this is taking 20 seconds to get from this scene to this scene. I want 20 seconds, in the next 5 seconds. And you get very good at writing music in kind of real time.
Yes, okay. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you need 20 seconds. Here it is, And some people are really good at that. I'm not so good at that. I just think, oh, Christ, 20 seconds. Can you give me a day to think about
that? Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And there's a slight danger that you then do things which you later regret.
Yeah, because then it's hard to then unpick it from all the rest of them.
It really gets more and more difficult to unpick it. And that is certainly a thing about tech, is once everybody's involved and the lighting is there and the design is there and everything is there, then unpicking things becomes huge. And then when you get into previews and you do start to unpick things, you can find that you're spending 2 hours unpicking something that lasts for 3 minutes.
Yeah, because all of those things have been timed to the music perfectly and sort of rehearsed in exactly. And programmed in and all that kind of stuff.
Programmed into people's brains, of course, not only into the machines, but programmed into people's brains. And unknitting that is a huge job unraveling.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see the way that Rufus Norris works. I think it's really interesting. He sees right through past the end of the tech when he's working on something. He sees the previews as being really important because that is where you've made a lot of on the hoof decisions. Some of them are good, some of them are not so good. And then in the preview, you're finessing things and you're taking things that are good and making them better, and you're taking them things that are wrong and kind of putting them into shape. And he really enjoys that bit and works right up until the press night, right up until the press night, making sure that it's absolutely there. And I can see that. I used to think, God, that's a bit unfair on the people that saw the first preview. You know, job's only half done. But but actually, people who come to the previews tend to understand that. They tend to understand their guinea pigs, and they quite like it.
I was going to say, quite like it. Yeah.
Actually, Rufus did a brilliant, brilliant Tintin piece that I did the music for, which opened at the Barbican, I think, and everything went wrong at the first preview. Oh. Absolutely every technical thing went wrong. There was a lot of flying that all went wrong, and it was just totally chaotic. and he brilliantly came on when the first thing went wrong, the first of many, many things, and chatted to the audience, introduced the crew and the actors. And then, you know, we went on a bit, did another half hour, then something else went horribly wrong, came back on again. People just loved it. I mean, I think the audience on that night will never forget it. And they so enjoyed being kind of complicit in this chaos.
Yeah.
And seeing the insides of theatre, basically. It was like, you know, because so much of theatre is about a kind of... you know, artificial magic. You know.
Yeah, it's all a sort of facade.
And it's like the facade had just fallen down. You know, somebody flies off into the wings and it's magic. But then somebody flies off into the wings and then the whole thing kind of goes belly up. It's not magic, but it's also rather lovely to see that, you know. And in fact, because there's that play called the play that went wrong, you know, all that. Actually, it's incredibly enjoyable to see all that kind of stuff. And Rufus just handled it so brilliantly because he made it into a, you know, he made it into an event in itself.
Yeah,
an evening to remember.
Well, that brings us very nicely to the end of quickfire questions. So I would love to talk to you now about kind of theatre more generally. And I was wondering how you feel theatre benefits us as a human race. Big question.
Well, yes. Yeah, I'm really obsessed with this. I mean, I think theatre helps us to understand ourselves.
Yeah.
And the way that the world is, particularly the way that the world is working at the moment, which maybe is sort of almost the same thing. At the moment, I'm working on a piece that I'm really enjoying, which is an opera called Bloom Britannia. And we're doing it in Hastings later this year. And the opera is set in a coastal town which is very, very like Hastings, in a time which is very, very like now. We always said it was going to be a post-Brexit black comedy, which is the only way to think of Brexit. And so what we have done, Stephen Place, who writes the libretto, and Polly Graham is directing, and Jenny Miller, who's producing it, it was to set up a whole lot of meetings with local people and talk about the way that Hastings is at the moment. And it's, to me, an unbelievably fascinating subject. Hastings is a town which has a kind of old school, kind of kiss me quick seaside thing going on, quite a powerful one. It has an amazing art scene and a lot of people giving up on London and coming down to live there. So it's an extremely creative place. It's an incredibly chaotic place, big drug problems. It has some of the poorest areas in the whole of the United Kingdom, amazingly. It has fishermen who all voted for Brexit and are probably regretting that. And so kind of some kind of local industry. And it's, to me, it's like a microcosm of Britain. And by writing this opera and by engaging the local people in helping us and then obviously performing in it, would at least attempting to do exactly what I think theatre should be doing, God, that's so pompous, that I would like theatre to be doing, which is kind of engaging on how we think, why we think like that, how we might think differently in the future, without it being like a kind of polemical thing. It's obviously, it's art, it's not polemics, although sometimes it's a fine line break. But by getting people to think about those issues, I feel that we are doing society, you know, a good turn. And I think that's as much as we can, I think it's as much as we can hope to do with theatre. I mean, you can do very more polemic pieces. Our piece isn't polemic, it's a comedy, actually. But I hope by doing that, when people are changing the way they think. Then I think of a play like Emilia, which was on more or less at the same time as Ian at the Globe, which was very polemical about, it was a very polemically feminist piece. And again, that's good too. That kind of really got people going. It definitely got people talking. And not everybody liked it, but it just really got people thinking about the way they live. So you can go out, have a really good evening out, really enjoyable, very funny play. But also it just sets your mind racing about how the world works. Well, what could be better than that? You know, that's a great combination. So, yeah, I think that's what I want from theatre. But then there are other times when I go to theatre and what I take from it is not about meaning. It's sometimes much more abstract than that. Like a really good abstract dance piece, it doesn't really necessarily make you feel anything about the way that the world works. It might make you think about the relationships between people, because dancing is inevitably about relationships. But it presents images which are just stay in your mind, and that's absolutely fantastic in itself. Yeah, so it's not necessarily about meaning. Yeah, there's more to it. God, in fact, if I think about this more carefully, I'm probably change my mind. There's more to it. Narrative. The sort of the whole narrative thing, and then there's the thing that's not that. It's much more mysterious. So mysterious about that, but it works on your brain. And there are things that I've seen in the theatre that I probably didn't even quite know what was going on, but they've stayed in my mind. I saw a piece in probably about 1980 called The Way of How by a brilliant American Californian director called George Coates, which I'll never forget. And it had this amazingly brilliant stage picture in which there was quite a complex set with a lot of very complex textures, and then performers who were dressed very similarly to the set. And a performer could walk across the set and you'd see them walking, and then they just disappear when they got halfway through. Talk about stage magic. And magic that could presumably go wrong. Yeah. It was just absolutely fabulous. And what is that? What's that? That's not thinking about the way the world works or anything. That's just being completely transported into a kind of magic land. And that aspect of theatre I really, really like. I get it a lot, actually, with when watching Robert Lepage pieces. I mean, Robert Lepage pieces have a lot of narrative in them, but they often have a lot of those moments where you just think, oh, wow, you know, and later you think, how on earth did they do that? That was absolutely fantastic. But at the time, you're not even thinking that. You're just thinking, I'm in another world, you know, and it's a world that you often get in film, but you sort of know in film that you can cheat a lot. Well, actually, you can cheat in theory. But there's something particularly, particularly amazing about seeing something very magic
and live in front of you. I think that's the difference, isn't it?
It's live in front of you. Yeah.
So it can go wrong, but this time it hasn't. It's gone perfectly, or you know,
it's
whatever.
It's gone perfectly. Yeah, no, that's right.
Yeah. What do you feel like there needs to be more of in theatre, or indeed less of?
Well, that's a very interesting question. More singing. I think, yeah, I've been very interested in the idea of institutions, theatrical institutions, and how they work. And I've noticed that if you build a theatre and you think you're building this brilliant sort of state-of-the-art auditorium, it seems like the place opens and you discover 10 minutes later that it's not quite doing what you wanted it to, because it's too prescriptive, I think. And that you have this fantastic desire to do a piece in the foyer instead, because the theatre's not quite what it should be. And I wrestle with that idea. I don't know kind of where I'm going with this thought. I think it's to do with institutions being able to be more flexible. And of course, some theatre spaces are quite flexible. Mm. You can move them around a bit. You can move the seating around a bit. That's nice. I mean, like the Limbury Theatre, which I don't particularly like, but it was very good in the way that you could have it sort of front on, or you could make it theatre in the round. That's all quite good. Mm. And then I heard about an amazing theatre that somebody had designed somewhere in America, where you could actually take the walls out in some way. And so it became partly an open air space. And I thought, oh, that sounds interesting.
That's exciting, yeah.
Because sometimes I know when I'm making theatre, and it happened a lot when I was working with this choir, The Shout, because we made a lot of music theatre, that I wanted something that wasn't anything that existed. And actually sometimes what I wanted, and then sometimes what I wanted was a room. I just wanted a room. But I wanted a room with a lot of lighting possibilities.
Yes.
So yeah, I think it would be very interesting to think about very, very flexible ways of designing new theatres. And people are moving towards that. I mean, certainly a modern theatre is more flexible than the Theatre Royal in Brighton, let's say, which was 19th century theatre, where it was assumed that you needed a proscenium and that everybody could be sat, had to sit, no question of standing or moving around. So it was very inflexible in those days. And I realise that things have progressed since then, but I wonder if there's another stage of flexibility that will allow us to be able to really do the pieces, to do things in the way that we like them. Because often we can work within what's there, but it's frustrating. It's not quite right.
Mm.
And then we find ourselves working in other spaces. I mean, like Punch Drunk, working in big industrial buildings and so on, which I think is fantastic, such a good idea. They can be brilliant. They can also often be very problematic, very, very tricky. Often particularly tricky for music, actually, because industrial spaces often have insane amount of acoustic. And so everything turns into a complete mush. And I've worked in that way quite often. Obviously, in churches, it can be really true, but it's also true in industrial spaces. So what's weird is that you can have an idea for a piece and think, I want to put this on in London. And actually, not be able to find anywhere that's right for it.
Yeah.
And that's really odd. That's really odd because London is amazing for theatre. It's got loads of theatres and it's really vibrant. Mm. And yet there's something about the fabric that's not quite right.
Mm.
Yeah, I wish I were an architect and that would be interesting. Well,
yeah. It's your next venture. A big question. What do you feel is the best thing about theatre?
Oh, I think it's something to do with it's about a place where magic can happen, narratives can happen, but it's so immediate. It's about being in a room with people who are, they're not making it up as they go along, but it feels like that. It feels, it's the liveness of it. And it's the, and I feel the same about music too. It's that feeling of being in the room when people are actually creating something.
Yeah.
And I've enjoyed doing jobs on telly and film, but not so much. And I think I've missed that aspect of them. I mean, there's lots of brilliant things about TV and film, and they're very collaborative and it's very interesting to be part of something like that. But they don't have that thing, and they don't have the adrenaline rush.
Yeah. Because I guess the adrenaline of a film comes when you watch it in its complete, sense.
Yeah, I suppose there are, I guess if you're a director, film director, it must be incredibly exciting if you're on set with, hundreds of people.
Mm.
But as a composer, you're kind of tucked away and you're working after it's all been filmed.
Mm.
Whereas, this is just selfish as a composer. In theatre, you're very much in on the rehearsals and everything.
Yeah.
But I think from a point of view of an audience, the exciting thing is just the immediacy of it.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Mm. So for this next part of the podcast, I've asked you to prepare a letter addressed to theatre itself. I absolutely love hearing these letters because everyone takes such a different approach and they're so wonderfully individual.
Oh, that's good. Actually, mine's got things that we've just been talking about, actually.
Oh, good. Linking it in.
Linking it in.
So, yeah, if you're ready, I would love to hear your Dear Theatre letter.
Okay. Dear Theatre, how lovely of you to write. Very pleased to hear you've had your jabs. I'm guessing that since you're several thousand years old, you probably had them early on. I'm sorry there's so little going on at the moment and you're obviously feeling under the cosh. But I don't think you should be too worried. You've been under threat before when film started to gain traction, everyone wrote you off. And then again, when television insinuated itself into people's homes, but they failed to see you off. It was the same for live music with the advent of recording, vinyl cassette CDs. It turns out you and live music are resilient. You're providing something that everybody profoundly needs. Be in a room with a group of people in the thick of it, in the thick of creation, talking, singing, playing instruments, dancing, in direct communication with the audience. Every performance different, uncertain, dangerous, on the edge. So I'm optimistic. Come the summer, there will be a groundswell. You'll be back in action. You better be. I need you. Love from Orlando.
Oh, that was lovely. That was really lovely. That's the crux of it, isn't it? We need it. We need it back.
We need it back. We definitely need it back. And I'm optimistic at the moment.
Mm.
And there's no doubt that people will be very keen to get back.
Yeah. And I think I've seen various things sort of going around saying, when theatre comes back, are you excited to buy a ticket? And I think there's no question. I think people will be absolutely, running for the doors to get back into theatres. I think it's something we've all been missing.
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think there will be some people who are a bit kind of, I've been so careful.
Sure.
I don't want to blow it now. But I think most people, actually people are feeling a bit demob happy already, actually. Also a bit kind of fed up with the whole thing. So, I think it's good. We see that a lot of festivals are happening. Some aren't, Glasgow, but some are. And I think, people will be out there. Yeah.
Yeah, are just ready for it, aren't they, to be able to feel that.
People are ready for it.
Yeah.
And online, it's been amazing. And I think people have been so ingenious. It's really been fantastic. But I must say, I'm one of those. I think it's quite old school. I'm not really interested in watching theatre online. It doesn't really do it for me. Because I think I just miss that immediacy. And if you're going to do it online, then I prefer to watch a film. Which is much more constructed. So I haven't seen any theatre for God knows how long. And I'd love to get in there again.
Yeah, no, I feel the exact same about it. I think the only thing that I have found really brilliant about the theatre online thing is there's been quite a lot of shows that I've not been able to see because I have been working or various reasons. And actually, they're shows that have then been broadcast during this time, which has been like incredible because I've been able to see these shows that I've missed, which has been great. But I completely agree. I saw Romantics Anonymous, which was Emma Rice's show that she did in the Sam Wanamaker. She did it. She did a live stream of it. And it was so brilliant to see a live stream of it. I saw it in the Sam Wanamaker when it was on, but then I watched the live stream and it was brilliant and it was really moving and really engaging, but there was just that level removed for me. I'd seen it in its beautiful,
in its beautiful version.
In real life. And seeing it on a screen was just not quite the same. It was still brilliant. Still very clever and still very brilliant and still very engaging. But just not being in the room was just, I just not wanted to be in that room.
I completely agree with you that come summer, I think we'll be back in there.
I mean, everything I have is crossed for all of that.
Absolutely. And for me, I mean, for us, it's kind of selfish too.
Well, yeah, quite, I mean, absolutely.
Quite like a few jobs.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you very much for sharing that letter with me. That was really lovely to hear. So we're now moving into the final section, which is a new feature for this series. It's called the Inspiration Station. I love hearing about people's things that excite them and inspire them. And I think there's such joy to be found in other people's enthusiasm. So I would love to know who inspires you.
I live in Brighton and I'm lucky enough to be in a constituency where I actually felt really, really enthusiastic about the MP that I was trying to elect, and she got in. In fact, she has been in for the last 10 years. It's Caroline Lucas, and I think she's an absolutely wonderful politician. And I have such admiration for her. I mean, the Green Party is problematic in that it only has one seat, one MP. And it's always incredibly disappointing to me that it doesn't do better. I can't quite understand why, actually. But I think that Caroline is absolutely brilliant, apart from the fact that I have to agree with practically everything she says. She's also a wonderful constituency MP, and she's a wonderful MP genuinely. She's campaigning on things that really, really matter, and she doesn't tell lies, and she's not compromised. I mean, actually, it's of course in some ways easier in a tiny party. The Labour Party, how do you you've got to compromise all the time because it's such a huge party. Conservatives the same. Whereas she can follow, she follows her instincts, and is not compromised. And I have such admiration for that. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. I'm inspired. This is a kind of incredibly random list. the novelist, Ali Smith. Oh my God, such a genius. She's so amazing. She writes, I mean, her what's it called? Not a trilogy, if it's got four, quadrilogy. Her series, Autumn, Winter, Spring, Summer, it's just, now that is an amazing way. It's like the piece I was talking about in Hastings. She's taken stuff that's going on in the world at the moment and just put it through her amazing observational powers and powers of inventing narrative and created these fabulous books that just react to the world as it is. They're so, so brilliant. And she has which kind of had so much influence on the way that I think. And actually, I write. I've just written a book about Brighton, and it's kind of, it's trying to imagine what Annie Smith would say about Brighton. Carol Churchill. Mm. Carol Churchill, who I've worked with quite a lot, is just a hero. Her plays explore the world in the most, I mean, actually rather like Ali Smith's, I mean, not that they have the same viewpoint or anything, but just the way that they explore the world in such a profound way and just look at things in a way that I would never have thought of. And so as well as being fascinating, entertaining, and amazing, they also make me think differently. And that's really, really worthwhile.
Mm.
Virat Kohli, the captain of the Indian cricket team, amazing. What an amazing player, an amazing man, and just astonishingly brilliant at what he does. I'm a cricket freak, and he is an absolute genius. Yes, and he's a man. That's unusual. All the other people I really like are all women. Yeah, Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, you know, like Caroline Lucas, she has this ability to just see right through things and not compromise her principles in a way that every other American politician seems to do. Those kind of people I really, really admire, because I think being a politician is a really incredibly tricky job. So they're very, I mean, you could say, am I inspired by those people? In a way, I ought to go out and try to be those people, but of course that's a lifetime's work, I think, and I'm not going to do it. And then I'm inspired, you know, I'm incredibly inspired by lots of dead people as well. You know, I'm inspired by Monteverdi. I mean, absolutely amazing genius. His music is just gets me, everything that he wrote just gets right into my soul. God, what a random selection.
I love the variety. Next question is, what inspires you?
Good theatre. The going walking on the downs, it's one of the privileges of living in Brighton, is to be able to go either, in our case, a couple of hundred yards down the street and get to the sea, which is actually, it's really coming into its own in COVID. It's been really, really nice, actually. And the beach has kind of thrived in COVID. Some people would say it's thrived too much, but actually it's been fine. And it's really been a brilliant place to be. Mm. And then going in the other direction, north, being able to go up onto the downs with our dog, Edie, a lovely whippet, Bedlington pug, and walk. And the downs, I find, why are they inspiring? There's something about being part of this landscape, which you understand has been there for thousands of years.
Mm.
And I'm generally up there kind of thinking about projects that I'm doing. So it's a really, for me, it's a really nice combination. I don't know why. Mm. I go up, actually, directly due north of here is Devil's Dyke, which is really an amazing feature. It's this very, very, very extremely deep valley, kind of cleft in the hills. And you just get this really strong sensation of history and being within this landscape, which has got, you know, thousands and millions of people have tramped over it, and there you are. And then there you are, sort of the last person to be up there. So that I find very inspiring.
So we're nearly at the end of our time together, but I would love to hand over the reins to you for a moment for if there's anything else that you'd like to say, get off your chest, promote, send out into the world. The floor is yours if you wish to have it.
Well, come and see Bloom Britannia in Hastings. Is that allowed?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Go ahead, promote
it. In October. Yeah, actually, it's a bit far away. People will forget. Never mind. Yeah, no, I think it'll be really good. It'll be really good fun. It's very funny. It's got a very, very, very good libretto by Stephen Place, who actually also happens to live in Brighton. Stephen is a very, very interesting man. He's probably the only person in Britain who could say genuinely that his job is a librettist for operas. I mean, that is quite something, actually, because normally it's something you do occasionally, write the libretto for an opera.
Yeah.
He's written very, very many, and he's got really, really good at it. And he's managed to distill, he's done this standard State of the Nation libretto. He's managed to distill everything that's going on in Britain at the moment into this two-hour piece and in a very, very funny way. So that's nice. And the music's quite frisky as well. So, Sunday, end of October this year.
Great.
I don't usually advertise myself, but then, anyway.
No, I love it. I love it. I think it's brilliant. You should absolutely advertise yourself. Orlando, thank you so much. This has been an absolute pleasure. What a lovely way to spend a Friday morning.
Talking about theatre, I realised actually when I was thinking about this that it's a huge part of my life. It's been. I hadn't really thought about that and how dependent on it I've been, and how, you know, it's like. And it hadn't occurred to me. My grandfather was a very successful actor, Leslie Banks. It's been around in my family. It's there. But I never thought, you know, because I'm not an actor, I never thought of being part of that, really.
Yeah.
And yet, at least the last 40 years of my life have been pretty much all about that. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Anyway, there we are. Thank you very much for inviting me.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of That's Theatre Darling. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. If you fancy giving the equivalent of a round of applause, you can do this by taking a moment to leave a review, subscribe, and why not just tell all of your friends about it. See you next time.